So we're just going to kind of get after it, right? We're going to give you a brief intro. We are recording, and we'll just kind of take it from there. We've done a little bit of research on you, but this is the head game. It's one that we all play. So sit back, relax, have a cup of tropical Java or whatever the drink is down there, and looking forward to it. So
yeah, me too. I'm excited. This is going to be fun.
First and foremost, thank you, Mr. Hugo Armando. He's our guest today on the Head Game, former tennis pro as well as current tennis coach. We want to know everything and anything about you. But first and foremost, the Head Game is all about the exploration of the athlete's mind. We like to say that life is a performance. And when you have the opportunity to perform, there are a certain number of elements that always come into play. So you are really that valuable asset for us in the world of tennis. And for that reason, we want to pick your brain as much as we can. So let's start off by just a brief introduction. Tell me a little bit about how you first got into the sport of tennis and what that was like for you. And above all else, major influences, how it came more part of your DNA and how it sort of evolved to really a career.
Yeah, totally. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to speak with you guys. I'm just very happy to be able to be here. I started to play tennis by accident, really. I have an older sister who's 5 years older than me, and she was the tennis player. I was a soccer player as a young kid. My dad, being a professional soccer player, was always hoping that I'd follow in his footsteps. And I was playing peewee soccer that was based out of a tennis club in Argentina, where my parents are from. And after soccer practice, I went and watched my sister have her tennis lesson. And the boy that was supposed to come after her didn't show for his lesson. And the coach was like, why don't you get out here and hit a few balls? And initially I was very against it. As my dad always said, you're playing soccer, don't grab a tennis racket, stick to soccer. And finally I caved and I started hitting some balls, and the coach was just, you know, kind of shocked a little bit. He's like, oh, so you've played before, how long have you played? And I was like, no, this is the first time I ever grabbed a racket. And from that first moment that I walked on a tennis court, I just started to like the game more and more. And a weekly lesson turned into a 2 days a week, and then 3 days a week. And then it became a 6 to 7 day a week thing where I was just, you know, all in on it. And it's just been great. The biggest thing that I've been fortunate enough to have is just good people as I was growing up. And I always was surrounded with good coaches that didn't just teach me, you know, how to play the game of tennis, but more importantly, what it's about and what I can get out of it. You know, there's so many life lessons that you can learn through sports in general, but specifically tennis. And that's what really, you know, got me hooked onto it. It was that I felt that I was just learning more than a sport. I was learning how to do, you know, day-to-day things and life lessons while having fun at the same time. And, you know, my dad being a professional athlete was a big help. He played very high competitive soccer in Argentina, which is, you know, soccer is huge down there. So he understood, you know, the pressures of having to perform or the expectations. And so, you know, my dad for sure is, you know, my top influence, and it always has been. He ended up coaching me through my pro career as well. And I would have to say the two or three coaches that I had growing up, like I mentioned earlier, that taught me more than just a game of tennis are also, you know, massive influences still on me to today. I still have a great relationship with all of them.
Yeah. You keep mentioning kind of the more than tennis. Talk to me a little bit about that. What is that more to tennis that you found in your career and the coaches and the people around you?
Yeah. There's so many life lessons, whether it's, you know, dealing with pressure and expectation, how to handle success, how to handle defeat, how to handle frustration, understanding the things that we can and can't control, and how to respond to those things, which is huge. And, you know, how to set goals and work hard towards them and be dedicated. Just to be grateful for the opportunities that you have and for what you're doing. The list is endless. It's just really, it amazes me. And it's why I love the game of tennis so much, is why I'm so grateful for the game of tennis and why I love doing what I do now, which is, you know, the coaching side of the sport.
Hugo, when you first began your career, you mentioned your father being a professional athlete, Argentinian soccer player, soccer being such a monumental sport in South America. When that impact first kind of dawned on you that your dad was a pro athlete, talk to me about your mindset as far as whatever sport you were playing at the time. You started in his footsteps in soccer. What was that like, that learning curve, just really growing up with someone who was your father, who was also at the top of their game?
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, I didn't realize how good my dad was until, you know, I got a little bit older. So, you know, as far as soccer went, I thought that he was a know-all, tell-all, you know, and he was just my idol. So I would, you know, listen with open ears and open eyes every time he was giving me a tip as far as soccer went. I just really enjoyed spending time with him on the soccer field and just having fun. And then there came a point where I was kind of in between soccer and tennis. And I always joke with my dad, and I said, well, I actually chose tennis because I thought you'd butt out of the way. But then he ended up coaching me throughout my whole pro career, so it didn't really work out that way. But no, he was always really good. And, you know, looking back now, through my junior tennis days, there were some things or decisions he would help me make. And I didn't really understand, like, you know, he was very against me playing tennis on weekends if I didn't have a tournament. And he's like, just go have fun and hang out with your kid, with your friends, and be a kid. And, you know, I had all these other, you know, friends slash competitors I was competing against, and, you know, they're training through the weekend and, you know, working hard. And I'm just like, man, why am I taking 2 days off right now? And, you know, later on, I realized that, you know, he always kept me hungry for the game by doing that. I, you know, when Monday came around, I was like, you know, had my bag and ready to walk on the court and run all day, as opposed to, you know, being burnt out or getting tired of the sport. Or so he was very smart in the way that he kind of, you know, guided me through my junior career. And he always, you know, made it very clear that it wasn't about winning or losing. It was about, you know, my attitude and my work ethic and trying to make the most of wins and defeat, right? So, you know, if you lose, you know, try to understand why you lost and just go out there and get better at that. And if you win, understand that it doesn't erase maybe some of the things that you got away with and you didn't do so well, that you still need to analyze things when you win as well. So it was always a positive situation regardless of the score. So he was never really big on the winning aspect. It was more of the development as a person and as a tennis player for him than me just winning.
You talked about him as an influence and the other people who had an influence on you. And I think about tennis as it's a pretty individualized sport, an individual sport, unless you're playing doubles, of course. What are the things that you felt like you were taking into those games, but that you learned yourself kind of as you had to play, right? I think people can tell us all these things and then we really have to experience it ourselves. So what's something that you felt like you've experienced that kind of you learned by doing and achieving that way?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that I learned is that, you know, as tennis players, we have zero control over the result of a match. And sometimes we fool ourselves into believing that we do. But, you know, I can remember many matches where I walked off the court feeling like I played some of the best tennis that I can possibly play. And I still ended up losing. So I think understanding, you know, the things that you can control and things that you can't, and not, you know, stressing about the things that we can't control and really, really focus on the things that we can, no matter how little or big they might be, but really, really concentrating on what we can control and what we can do to improve. I think that's gotta be probably the number one thing.
Hugo, break that down for me just a little bit more, because I think when you think about different sports, I've always been a team sport player. My sports were football and baseball. And yes, there are certain elements like you can't control, but in football, if you ran the triple option and you couldn't control it if it rained that day on whether or not there were too many turnovers. Right. Talk to me a little bit more about you making that specific switch in your mind about what factors in the sport of tennis are those that you can versus cannot control. And then how does that dictate your game?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the weather conditions, the court, it's those are things you can't control. How your opponent's playing, you know, how you're feeling that day. You know, sometimes you wake up and your body's a little stiffer or a little bit sore, or maybe, you know, you're not serving well that day. And instead of sitting there and saying, man, I wish I was serving better, or, you know, I wish the court was a little quicker so it suits my game more, you just gotta find a way to put your best effort out there and give yourself the best possible chance to win, regardless of those things, whether it's, you know, my movement's not there today, or my forehand, which is my weapon, is just not, didn't show up that day. There's still ways where you can win. The majority of the time, honestly, you're almost never 100% on your game when you're walking out onto the tennis court. I could probably count on both hands on during the 12 years that I played pro tennis on days where I felt like everything was perfect. So you just got to understand that, you know, you have no control over how well your opponent's playing. You might be playing really well, but if he's playing a little bit better, or he just plays important points a little bit better, then things are going to go his way. And there's a lot of perspective that goes into having that outlook and accepting also, you know, if it doesn't go your way, of saying, hey, you know what? I did everything I could. I prepared as well as I could. And I really competed as well as I could have today. And even though it didn't go my way, I know that if in my next four or five or however many tournaments I compete the way that I competed today, my chances of winning are going to be very high. And I think that's where the focus needs to be on.
I can hear the experience in the way that you're talking about that. And I'm wondering, with some of the younger players that you're developing, or somebody maybe the new to the kind of the pro scene, do they have that same mentality, or is this something that you really are imparting on them? How are you doing that?
It's, you know, they're all different. I always say that one of the things I love the most about coaching is trying to understand each player that I work with, because they're all so different. You know, they're motivated by different things, or they have different frustrations, and they have different backgrounds, and they were taught different ways. So it's really just, you know, on a player to player basis. And I have a little bit of both. You know, I have some kids that have really struggled understanding this concept and that are very result oriented, and they're all about, you know, winning and losing. And that's kind of the only thing they throw up on the chalkboard. And I have kids that, that are really trying to grasp this. And this is, you know, this is not something that just junior players deal with. There's guys and women at the top level of the game that are struggling with understanding this concept. And, you know, the second that they get it and they're able to let go of the result, it's amazing how much more relaxed and free they go out on the tennis court and play. And that's all it takes, really. It's just that one time where they're, you know, they're brave enough, or they're willing to say, okay, you know what, I'm going to try this. What's the worst thing that can happen is I'm going to lose a tennis match. So it's really cool to see when they make that switch and they see it for themselves, because at the end of the day, that's really what it takes. It's for them to go through the experience, you know, themselves to realize it. That's what happened to me when I played. I mean, my dad could tell me some things, you know, 10 times, and until I actually went through it on the tennis court, I look back and I'm like, hey, I know you've been saying this for 6 months, but I finally got it because I went through it. So that's the coolest thing for me, is to see them that moment when it happens. And then, you know, nobody's perfect. There are going to be times where they have setbacks and they go back to, you know, walking onto the court and playing not to lose as opposed to win. But the idea is for them to be, you know, more and more consistent every time they walk onto the court, to have that mentality and that attitude.
You mentioned earlier, Hugo, when we were talking about the art of playing the game of tennis, that an acceptance, a level of acceptance is a crucial piece. When you say acceptance, I start to think about judgment. And right, that starts to kind of get into our wheelhouse of what we're working with on our athletes. When I was just sharing with Hunter about an hour or so ago, there was an article on LinkedIn that was posted by one of the performance directors for the Arizona Diamondbacks Major League Baseball organization, discussing the value of aiding mental health in athletes. And it really spoke to me. It stirred a lot of conversation amongst us. Judgment so often sticks with the performer long after the so-called mistake has come and gone. And it's the judgment of what wins versus losses truly means that I think starts to sculpt the emotional relationship that athletes have with their game. whatever it might be. Talk to me about when you see that judgment as a coach, being a former player, how do you attack it?
Yeah, I mean, especially in juniors, you see a lot of attachment to results and then and them kind of, you know, having the thought of, well, you know, if I'm losing matches or I'm not doing well, that means that, I'm a loser or I'm not good enough. So, you know, that's something that I take really serious, especially with young juniors. And again, I try to implement with them the mentality of, you know, the most important thing is what they tell themselves, right? How they view things. People around you, whether it's, you know, a college coach that's recruiting you or other coaches or other players, whether you play great or you play bad or you're doing things the right way or the wrong way, they're always going to have their opinion. And again, that's one of the things that we cannot control. So the most important part is their outlook and what they're telling themselves and the conversations they're having with themselves. So, you know, I try to explain to them that your tennis results is in no way, shape, or form a reflection of who they are as a person. But the way that they compete, their attitude, their discipline, how they prepare, all things which they can control, you know, can say a lot about who they are beyond the result of a tennis match. And that's what I really want them to understand and work on as far as their tennis goes, more than anything. Once they're able to do that, then you can, you know, begin to talk about the tennis and you know, and the strategy and the technical stuff. But the head game and the mind is really the number one aspect for a tennis player, hands down, by far.
You said it. You said the word. You said head game, right?
Yeah.
It's the game we all play.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I mean, there's so many top level players that if you were to study, you know, under a lens, technically, they're not extremely technically sound. You know, there's a lot of top men and women that their strokes are not technically sound, but you know, their head game is, and that's the reason why they're up there. However, if you have a player that is perfectly technically sound and is an athletic specimen and has it all, but the head game is not there, I guarantee you they're not going to get very far. And if they do have some good results, it's not going to be sustainable. So for me, the mental toughness, the head game is the number one thing to work on.
Hugo, talk to us a little bit about your own head game journey. You know, you mentioned the influence of your father. Just kind of walk us through your own career as you competed, where you ended up, you know, as far as you were ranked very high. We've seen other interviews that you've given where you've spoken about those level of successes. Talk to us a little bit more. Help us understand really what goes on in the head game of the professional tennis player.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a journey and it's a journey that doesn't end from the second that you know, start to take this serious and say, hey, you know, I want to play at a certain level. And it could be the pro level, or it could be a college level or junior college level, or even trying to make your high school team. But once you embark on that journey, you never stop improving and learning. I was lucky enough when I was 12 years old, I finished the year at number one in the country in the 12 and under division. And I was very lucky to spend a lot of time with Dr. Jim Lehrer as a young kid. And Jim almost became like a second dad to me throughout my junior career. And, you know, his guidance was, it was priceless for me. And still to this day, I have a pretty good relationship with him. So he helped me really understand a lot, the mental aspect of the game and really using rituals and, you know, how to approach the mental game. And the biggest thing that he taught me was, which I still use today with my kids, it's more important in tennis what you do in between points than what you do during the point, right? So the point maybe lasts 4 to 8 seconds, or maybe 10 or 12 if you're playing a really long point, but you have 20 to 25 seconds in between each point. So how you use those 20 to 25 seconds to prepare for the next point is way more important than what you do during the point. And again, like I said at the beginning, it's a journey. It's a journey that, you have to have a lot of patience for. Things don't come quickly. And like I said earlier as well, is you have to go through certain experience to really take these steps forwards and understand these lessons. And sometimes it might take years to look back and reflect on it and be like, oh, I get it now. This is why A, B, and C happened. But yeah, it's a journey. It takes time. And lessons are, and experiences are the number one teacher for it.
Yeah, I think about the McEnroe effects of tennis, and when you see that, and sometimes the frustration levels that come out with your ability. I know how to hit that shot, but when that doesn't necessarily occur, that difference that we have creates that frustration in us. Did you ever have a moment like that? And if you did, how did you find a way to kind of bounce back from it, or did it derail you?
Oh no, I definitely had those moments. I think we all do. I think that's what makes us human. And you know, sometimes I was able to catch myself in the middle of the match and bounce back, and a lot of times I wasn't, and it cost me the match. And again, that's when you reflect and you realize in the locker room after you've taken a cold shower and say, man, one, why did I do that? Two, I can't do that because it's never done anything positive or good for me. But you know, you have to have that willingness to look at it that way. I think to really dig deep and understand it and say, okay, why did it happen? Was it because I, you know, walked on the court expecting that I was going to win, or expecting to play the way I played yesterday? And, you know, there's so many things that get in the way that lead you to reach to that point. And it's going to happen. It's inevitable. It happens to everybody. But I think the most important thing is to try and be present and consistent with not letting it happen, or you know, doing the right thing so your mind doesn't go in that direction. And as long as you can do that, you know, 70-80% of the time, then you know, the chances are that you are going to have a good result. Because it's impossible to do it 100% of the time. Even 90% of the times is crazy. But as long as the path of consistency is leveled and it has some upward peaks, then you're going in the right direction.
Yeah, we talk about a thing called chaos, and for us, at least in our world, chaos is the ever-changing variables that place internal and external demand on a given task and disrupt our mental scripts, right? It's, oh, I got to hit this point. I should have hit that point. Well, you didn't. And so it's more so understanding what's our internal dialogue as a result of that. What's the external variables, weather, court surface, crowd, that's coming, opponent, and how they're playing. And we have to learn how to embrace our chaos. And that's a big thing that we like to teach our athletes too when we're working with them, is how to embrace that chaos, because chaos is inevitable. It's not if, it's when it occurs. And it's building those skills proactively ahead of time. And you're kind of mentioning, oh, I should have done that, or what I'm expecting of the match, versus go out and be the best player I can be today.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's funny that you say should, because I always tell, you know, when I'm working with players, I was like, listen, there's two words that I don't want to hear, and it's should and can't. Because there's no reason why, you know, you should beat this player today, or why you should have made that shot. It's like you said, you have to be in a frame of mind where you're trying to do things the best you can on that given day. And something that's helped me a lot, and I wish I would have looked at it this way when I played, but I didn't, was that for players that really struggle with the head game, you know, I tell them, listen, the only opportunity you have to work on these things are when you make mistakes. So look at the mistake as an opportunity, not as something you did bad or a reason to judge yourself, or like, so every time you make a mistake, the first word that pops into your head should be opportunity. Your opportunity to, you know, to analyze it, digest it, and problem solve it. And that is something that has helped me a ton. It takes time for kids to, you know, and players to look at it that way. But if they're able to do that, then there's going to be a lot of positive things coming from it for sure.
When you talk about opportunity and you talk about this window in which you can learn, you can grow, emotion in sport for anyone who has ever played, regardless of the level, is such a palpable characteristic. And you have the gradient. You have the highly emotional to the flattened affect, the poise, the stoic, the in control. I grew up with Jimmy Connors. I grew up with the, I think it was at the US Open where he points at each side, right? Pointing around. Yeah. And then there's the, I recollect the Yvonne Lendl, the stoic, the poise, the in control, the Bjorn Borg, the Boris Becker, the more stereotypical tennis players that are more about maintaining that complete sense of control. Where do you fall on that emotional spectrum? One, as a former player, but two, I'm even more interested in what do you encourage with your students?
Yeah, as far as I went, I think I was a little bit of everything, to be honest with you. I went through a few waves of where, you know, I tried to stay, you know, stoic, calm, and collective. But at times that felt like that kind of, you know, quieted me a little bit too much. And I couldn't, you know, get my blood going and pump myself up. And so I would find myself going through different ranges. Now, as a coach working with players, it's my job to really understand, you know, what type of player I'm working with and what type of personality they have and what their game style is like. So it's going to be really tough to have a player who has an aggressive game and likes to, you know, take control of the point and move forward and come to the net and expect them to have the stoic and quiet and kind of just reserved personality on the court. So I try to match their game and their personality to how I want them to act on the court. And what I do tell everybody is, you know, you have to celebrate the good points. I think there's so much pressure and tension that builds up in a tennis match, and you have to let it out somehow. And unfortunately, sometimes we let it out in a negative way by smashing a racket or crushing a ball out of the stadium. But if you can find positive ways to let that emotion out, whether it's, you know, yelling a come on, or, you know, like you saw Jimmy do that US Open where he was just going crazy, but it was all positive things, right? So I think that's a way for him to kind of just let go of everything that's been building up inside of him throughout the match in a positive way. And that's kind of what you want to do. It also sends a big message to your opponent. If, you know, you win a big point and you get in your opponent's face a little bit and give him a fist pump and yell, come on, then they're going up to the next point and they're going, man, this guy's all over me. He's just, you know, he's just going to come after me. So it sends a big message. It's a little bit of a poker game or a cat and mouse game that is so fun in tennis, where, you know, you gotta give off this vibe of positivity and, you know, I'm ready to go every single point, which I think is what Nadal does so well. I mean, the guy is just, he plays every point like it's the last point he's going to play of his life. And it's just, and you feel it. I mean, I was lucky and unlucky enough to play him. And it was just that I felt suffocated before every point. I just felt like this guy was going to jump across the net and punch me in the face every single point.
Yeah. What is it about him that shows that comes off? Is it his dominant game? Is it knowing, okay, this is, you know, a top three in the world? What is it like? What is that factor that might bring that out in terms of opponents even?
I think it's all of it. I think his, you know, his mindset, his physicality, his game style, he's relentless. Like I said before, every point he plays is like a match point for him, whether it's the first point of the match or it actually is a match point. And he's just doesn't let up. I mean, it's almost like, I always describe this way when people ask me what it was like playing Nadal. It's like, you know, when you're a kid and you're playing this game of like dunking your friend under the water and, you know, trying to like keep each other under the water and you're trying to come up for air and you get a little bit of air and then you come back down. And it's just that constant feeling for the whole match, because the second that you think you have him on the ropes, he hits a shot out of nowhere and all of a sudden you're on the ropes and you're like, wait a second, I was a shot away from winning this point. Why am I a shot away from losing it? And that's just to do that for as long as he has, and to do it every single point for every match he plays, is just, it's incredible.
We talk often about the application of mental skills is our definition of what it is to be mentally strong. That mental strength is the application of skills that you've learned, that you've been taught, whether it's through direct observation or through a learning experience. When you are working with your tennis players and you see them struggling mentally, talk to me a little bit about when you pull them aside, you're big on self-talk and that relationship they have with themselves. What is the application that you're really looking for? Because I think it's so incredibly vital for young athletes to have a better understanding of what they can actually do to help themselves in the moment. Because as you know, practice and game, or the notion of visualization and then it doing it in real time, is a very different experience. So what is it that you're trying to teach them to help apply that skill so they can be mentally strong?
The biggest thing I try to teach them is for them to really focus on their intentions, right? And then for them on the responses on different situations, right? If it's a pressure point and they lose it, like I said earlier, you have 20 seconds between each point. So you can either, you know, after a mistake, dwell on the mistake for 15 seconds and then give yourself 5 seconds to get ready for the next point. Or you can just look at the mistake, take 5 seconds to say, man, that was a really bad shot selection. Next time I need to hit it there or do this or do that. And then spend the next 15 minutes taking a deep breath, calming yourself down, understanding what happened and getting ready for the next point. So I think how to use that time is really, really important during a match. And again, there's a lot of times where I have players that get frustrated for lost points or mistakes made, but it wasn't that big of a mistake. I mean, their intentions and their idea was correct. So I don't want just the fact that they missed a shot for them to shy away from trying it again. So I really like teaching them about intentions and really, you know, having them judge their intentions, not so much the result or the outcome of the point or the situation.
I find a lot of people look to that, especially in the moment and in performance settings and when game time actually occurs or match time occurs, and not so much in practice. How did you maybe incorporate that type of training in your practice to make it more normalized? You talk about a lot of times the in-between points is the most important. Is that something that you're repping with your athletes or that you repped yourself in terms of, okay, game situation, match situation, set point, what am I thinking? What am I doing?
Yeah, that's something that I definitely, worked on as a junior player and even as a pro player as well. And that I'm doing now with the players that I coach is we have practice matches or practice sets that we play. And I like to create different situations. So I'll have the server, you know, maybe say, okay, the server only gets one serve for the whole set. So it's kind of a pressure situation, the fact that if you miss a serve, then it's a double fault. Or, you know, the returner is up 30 love every single game. So the server has to start, you know, love 30 from the beginning of the game. So I like to create situations. And there's, you know, so many situations you can come up with as far as tennis goes, but to make them uncomfortable, that they need to be comfortable being uncomfortable. That's just what it comes down to when you're competing. And the better you do that, the better chances you have of competing at your best. And at the same time, when we are doing these scenarios, I give them one or two things to focus on. I'm not big on throwing the kitchen sink at players. I like to keep it simple and give them one or two things to really focus on. And you know, one of them could be what you mentioned. I was like, hey, you know, I really don't care what the score of this practice set is, but I really care what you're doing between points. Are you going to the towel and taking a deep breath and doing your rituals before you serve or before you return? And so it's more about, you know, understanding, getting better and improving than the result when it comes to practice matches. I could care less about results when they're playing practice matches. I much rather have them focus on one or two things and just get better at it.
Hugo, you mentioned earlier that there's a cat and mouse element, almost a theatrical performance You mentioned Nadal. You mentioned the suffocation, the presence. All sounds to me like a very purposeful commitment as a professional athlete. Maybe a closer proximity to the net or your position on the court after a long back and forth where you win the point, how you celebrate. All of those things typically require a moderate level of endurance. One of the things that we emphasize at Mindful Athlete Training as the biggest performance inhibitor is mental fatigue. In some of our research, I was curious as to what was the longest tennis match ever played. And I came across, and you can fact check me on this, I came across a match, and I believe it was 2010, that over the course of 3 days went just over 11 hours.
Yes.
That was not, I was expecting maybe 5-6. And then yeah. I was not even aware of this. So talk to me a little bit about endurance for you as a tennis player, the role of fatigue, and maybe even a personal story of a too long moment for you on the tennis court.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're humans. We are going to get fatigue mentally and physically. And I think that's where we're scheduling and understanding their journey comes in, and understanding that this is a marathon, this isn't a sprint. So, you know, I think it's really important to be organized and be purposeful with the things that you do, you know, practice and having a tournament schedule. And, you know, it's funny, I talked to some parents and they're like, yeah, you know, my son played really bad this weekend. He looked really flat and he was all over the place emotionally. And I was like, well, you know, how many tournaments have you guys been playing? He's like, oh, this is the seventh tournament in a row. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course, you know, that's a lot. So I think you, as a player, you have to know yourself really well and know, you know, is it two or three tournaments in a row? That's my max. Or is it four? You know, and there's a lot of variables. Sometimes you play only two tournaments, but if you do really well in both of them, you end up playing, you know, 10 to 12 matches in 2 weeks in a 14-day stretch. Or if you could play five tournaments in a row and just play, you know, one tournament each week because you're not playing that well. And so there's so much that comes into play. But yeah, it's definitely a part of the journey at all levels, at the junior level and at the pro level. And I think that going back to what I was saying about my dad when I was a junior tennis, I think that's one of the things that he was trying to avoid, is that mental fatigue of getting burned out and, you know, not wanting to get out of bed and losing that hunger for the game and to compete. So I think you have to be really smart. It's just important to work hard than it is to recover. And I think nowadays they're starting to implement that a little bit more in understanding what an important role recovery plays, not just physically, but mentally as well. And yeah, I mean, I had many moments where I was just, you know, I just hit a wall and I said, you know, this is it. You know, I remember going to Europe. Back when I played, it was very different. We, you know, once we went over to Europe, we stayed there for a good 7 to 8 weeks and maybe we played three tournaments and took a week off. And I remember, I think I was supposed to be there in Europe maybe for 6 or 7 weeks. And I did really well. My first two tournaments, played a ton of matches and, you know, tough matches, draining emotionally and physically. And, you know, on the third or fourth week, I lost early in a tournament. I remember walking off the court and heading straight to the locker room, and my dad comes to join me and we start talking. And I was like, we need to go home. I was like, I, there's no way I can keep traveling for another 3 weeks. And he's like, no, let's take a day off. Let's, you know, let's recover. Let's think about this. And I was like, I need to go home. Like, and we ended up coming home for 1 week and, or 10 days, and then went back over there and, you know, I was fresh and ready to go again. But I think it's really important to have the patience and the awareness to see that and to analyze that and not just look for results and look for ranking points and be like, no, I got to keep playing because I got to, you know, keep my ranking up or try to get more points. And I think people get caught up in the result race too much and, you know, mental fatigue, which is a very serious thing, gets kind of, you know, tossed under the rug a little bit. But I think it's really important to have that awareness of, you know, where am I mentally? Can I keep going? Am I going to be at my best? Because at the end of the day, that's what you want. You want to be able to put yourself out there and walk on the court to compete, knowing that you're as close to your best as you can be.
Yeah, the mind's really interesting. And we like to say physical fitness is the gold standard right now. And mental fitness is, well, what does that mean? And I think people need to learn what mental fitness truly is. And if you think about physical fitness, you tend to be proactive about it. You're doing workouts, you're doing conditioning, you're doing exercises, and you've kind of talked about incorporating a little bit of some of those mental training into game scenarios. And we really talk a lot about that, as mental fitness allows for athletic performance or physical fitness to occur. And mental fatigue is something that you can actively train. It's something that you could be proactive about, but you're absolutely right. The brain is really interesting. When you wake up in the morning and you go to bed, your brain is slightly different. It's changing, it's growing. And just like a muscle grows not because of your working out, it's that's tearing the muscle, but then proper recovery allows it to grow stronger and endure more. Your brain is the same way. So it's about finding that good proper balance between how much can I strain it with proper recovery, and being more intentional about how you're straining it as well helps you to recover. And I think it's until you're a professional or until you're later in life when your physical gifts have already come out that it's like, oh, the mind is really important to start training. Versus at a younger age, it's something that you can be training so you can endure more. And I think that that road is still kind of blurred. It's not quite shown because physical fitness is talked about more. Mental fitness is slowly becoming something, but it's still seen as vague and not necessarily accurate. So I think being able to educate people more about that is really important, that you could be proactive about training your brain with proper recovery and finding a good balance between it and learning what yourself is too. And how far you can push. Can you push another 5 minutes? Can you push another 10, 2 days? And then, okay, I need to recover. And about stretching those boundaries is really important as part of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I really wish parents and you know, coaches as well understood how important it is to train the mind at from an early stage in development. Like I said earlier, you can have the best strokes in the world, but if your head game isn't there, it's you're not going to go very far. And then the opposite is also true, to where if you do have a very strong head game and you don't have to be technically sound or technically perfect to accomplish some pretty big things. So it's huge in my opinion. I've always felt that way. And I guess having such a positive experience with, you know, with Jim Lehrer at an early age when I was 12 years old, and then my dad always being a big believer in it, and him helping me with that as well. I've always thought that, you know, the head game is the number one priority for sure.
Hugo, when you talk about the relationship between the mind and the body, we're all about the integration effect, which is really a sense of emotional management, of focus, of that neuro timing of your muscles, really a holistic approach. And when you mentioned earlier the role that sometimes the mental game plays in how you actually physically perform, I think so often in today's world, especially the amateur athlete, you talked about juniors, they lose sight of how to train their brain the way they would train their body. And I think people who get it fully embrace it, and then they educate. What messages do you think, just being in the position that you're in? I mean, you're in Florida, you have your own school, you're a coach. What mental messages do you think are the most important for the young tennis player today?
I think it's a little bit of what you guys said earlier. I mean, you can train, you know, the mind like you train your muscles. You know, if you want to get your bicep bigger, you go to the gym and you do bicep curls. If you want to work on being more positive, then, you know, you can start a journal, and you can keep notes and write three positive things from every practice, every single day, or every match, or every tournament. And, you know, looking back at all these positive things that you do or you encounter on a day-to-day basis is going to help you build confidence. So, I mean, there's so many ways that you can work on your mental toughness, just like you work on your game, or your fitness level. So I think that's the biggest message to get across. I think a lot of, you know, coaches and parents have this belief that are like, oh, well, he was born with zero patience, so don't expect him to be patient. Well, okay, if he was born with zero patience, let's work on his patience, right? If you bring me your son with a terrible serve, I'm not going to work on his forehand. I'm going to work on his serve. So you can work at all these different, mental abilities. And that's what I try to explain to parents as much as I can.
When I work on my forehand, I can see if that's working. I think it's hard for people when they don't necessarily see the effects of the mental training as well. It's not as visible. It is kind of the invisible element. And it tends to be, well, that guy's mentally strong. Yeah, but you can be too, but it does take effort and work, but you don't always see those results.
Not as tangible, right?
Right. You don't see them until you need them.
Right.
And I think that becomes a problem because it tends to be a very reactive approach. Oh, that guy starts to smash the racket. Oh, he has intentional problems. Okay, now we'll do something.
Right.
Versus this is just something we're actively doing. You're never going to go into a tennis match without training forehand, backhand, serve.
Right.
That's something you're doing. It just becomes natural. And I think the mind can be very similar in that way, but there needs to be more educators about it to bridge that gap for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I try from an early age, even through practice, with kids that are starting to play the game or have recently started to play the game, to get them to understand the mental aspect of the game. There's a stat in tennis that, maybe some people are aware of, maybe some are not, but in order to routinely win a tennis match, let's say 6-3, 6-3 or 6-4, 6-3, which is a pretty routine score, you only have to win 52 or 53% of the points. Which if you think about it, you're like, man, that's doable. That's not that bad. I think the problem is, how are you going to deal with losing 48% of the points? Even kids that are beginning to compete, I start these conversations and start to let them know, it's like, hey, listen, making mistakes, it's all part of the game, but let's work on how to deal with those situations from an early stage. Like you said, just like we work on your forehand or your serve or your volleys, we're working on you understanding bad misses or understanding, the expectation to win. If you go to a tournament and you're the number one seed, what does that feel like? What does that mean? How should you approach that? Or if you're the underdog, these are all things that I think a lot of times aren't coached or talked about or explained. And I think it's a big mistake to let those windows of opportunities to bring these things to the table and make these kids aware of it at an early age. Cause then the sooner you make them aware of it, it just kind of becomes second nature later on. And that's kind of what the goal, I think, is that we want to get to, is to have these, 16, 17, 18 year old high level junior players with having this understanding already, because they did it at 12, 13, 14, as opposed to, them not working on it at all. And all of a sudden, it's a recruiting year and they're trying to go to a really good school and get recruited, but the head game's not where it needs to be. And so I think that's a big part of it.
What is it about the 48% though? I find that pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I love that stat. That's a great stat.
What is it about that you think people in general struggle with? The notion of disappointment or loss, the perception of that. Obviously, we have strong opinions about that's what we do every day. I'm just curious as to being, at the pinnacle of your game as a professional, that mental fortitude, that resiliency is something that's going to make or break, especially over the course of 1, 2, 3 tournaments. So you're talking about 6 or 8 weeks in Europe. What is it about the perception of failure that you think is so difficult for young athletes today to overcome?
I think it's tough for young athletes to stay in the moment. And, they lose 1 or 2 points in a row and they think, they start thinking like, oh my God, if I lose the next point, then I'm going to lose this game. And then if they break my serve, then I'm down 2-11. And it's like, while you're having this conversation in your head, you just played 3 or 4 points. So one mistake ends up costing them, a whole game or 2 games or 3 or 4 points, as opposed to one mistake just costing you 1 point, which is not that big a deal, because even if you lose 48% of those points, you still have a good shot of winning pretty routinely. So I think that's the tough part for them, is that they have a really tough time of staying present and staying in the moment and not worrying about the point that they just lost or what's going to happen if I lose the next 2 points. And I think that's when they start to get in trouble.
That statistic makes me think of my dad didn't let me play baseball because he's like, you're going to strike out at least, you know, 7 out of 10 times. And so don't play, because I was a little bit kind of a frustrated player. Ended up playing volleyball, ended up working out, ended up playing in college at the Olympic level. So that was kind of a good thing for me. But yeah, as
that you means think your about, father is always right.
Yeah. But as I think about that stat too, I think it, when you say next point or the next play, I think we have always talked about that, but I think the numerical aspect of it, of having it, that kind of grounds it a little bit. Hey, you can win only about half the points and still win the match.
Right.
And that really kind of, I think, defines like next play. Like yeah. this point is just one of many points.
Yeah.
And if I make a mistake, if there's an error, it's just opportunity to now bounce back from. As you were saying, the opportunity, stress, opportunity, right?
Right.
And they become similar and almost synonymous with each other. So I really like that concept.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, I try to really implement that outlook with all the players that I work with at all levels. And, you know, it where it gets really tricky is with the kids that are very result oriented, because, you know, they go from starting off a match and playing really well and everything's kind of under control and it's going their way, so everything's great. And the second they lose 2 or 3 points in a row, you can just kind of see it start to get in their head, and they start to, you know, their body language changes, their head starts to drop, their shoulders start to slump, they start to drag their racket, and it just, you see it coming. So, you know, again, if you can teach them about body language and, you know, keeping your shoulders back and holding your racket up and going to your towel, and these are all things that can be taught at a young age that can just become second nature by the time they're a little bit older. And it could help them tremendously, you know, in competition as they get older. And also, like I was saying at the beginning of the podcast, in life as well. I mean, you know, you're going to have bad days. Not every day is going to go your way, and you're not going to be feeling great every day. And you need to understand, you know, why it's happening and how to turn it into something positive and something to learn and grow from.
You've identified clay as your favorite surface to play on.
Yeah.
I find the elements of tennis fascinating, because being a football player, especially in the 80s, I didn't play a lot of games on turf. So my surface was grass.
Right.
And then playing baseball, same deal, not a lot of turf, majority grass, dirt. The right. surface underneath my feet never changed, but I also find it interesting and worth storytelling. The relationship between an inanimate object like a tennis ball as it's coming in contact with different surfaces. Talk to me about clay. I know you've played Wimbledon. Talk to me about grass.
Yeah.
What do the elements do for you as a tennis player as that pulse of the environment is encouraging you to interact back and forth?
Right. So they're all very different. So a clay court is going to make the game slower. It's going to make the movement a little bit trickier because sliding is involved. Now you can see, you know, you can slide into your shots. So you can defend a little bit better. The ball is going to slow down and kind of pop up for you. So you have more time, but, you know, in return, it makes the points longer. So it's more of a physical game. You need to be more patient.
More endurance.
Yeah. A lot more endurance. Your serve is not as effective on clay as it is on the other surfaces. So free points are hard to come by. Then on the other spectrum of clay, you have grass, which is, you know, polar opposite. It's very fast. The ball stays very low and skids. Footing's also tough because grass can be very slippery. So you play with shoes that have little stubs on the bottom for gripping. Points are shorter. Your serve becomes a lot more effective and a huge weapon on grass. So does you know, your slice, the different spins that you can use in the game. And then the hard court is kind of in the middle of those two, where points are, you know, could be long, if you're playing on a slow hard court, but your serve is still very effective. So you know the server has a bigger advantage on the hard court and the grass court than it does on clay. So the game is less physical, points are shorter. But yeah, I mean they're all very different, and it's such a cool experience to play on all three of them and really see the difference for yourself.
Yeah, I can imagine. What's the mindset like? Are you playing a stretch of grass tournaments, cork tournaments, or are you switching back and forth?
So the tennis season revolves around the four majors. So in January, we have the Australian Open, which is the first major of the year, and that's on hard court. So for the first quarter of the year, most of the tournaments are all on hard courts. And then now we're, April, mid-April to late April, starts the clay court season, which leads into the French Open, which is the only major that's played on clay. And that's mid to the end of May. So from now until end of May, maybe first week of June, you have all clay court events. Then right after that, the grass court season starts, which is the shortest season of the tennis season. You have Wimbledon, obviously, that's played on grass, and 2 to 3 weeks before that, and maybe a week after that, there are grass court tournaments. And then after Wimbledon, we go back onto the hard court leading, up to the US Open in New York.
So we were having some technical difficulties there.
Oh, no worries.
So I didn't hear much of what you had to say, so I'm not going to try to repeat anything that Hunter might have asked you.
Okay.
We talked about the surfaces. We talked about the relationship between the environments. Let's take it one step further. Talk to me a little bit about where you are presently and what you're doing with your career right now. Tell us more about your school. As you know, we're coming down to your neck of the woods. We're looking forward to meeting you, kind of sharing more about what we do. Josh McCumber, yourself, we're looking to get more into that holistic approach to helping athletes in the south part of Florida. How do we learn more about Hugo Armando?
Yeah, so that's great that you guys are coming down. I'm really excited to meeting you guys and getting to chat a bit more. So right now I'm based in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, and I work privately with 4 to 5 players. Two of them live full-time here in Florida. Three of them are from out of state, and they come anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks every month, or I might go to them. And coach them at their homes or go to tournaments with them. I'm in the middle of moving facilities. I was at the Benjamin School, a great private high school here in the area that has an amazing sports facility. And I'm in the process of moving to a club, hopefully soon, where I could set up something a little bit more structured, a little bit more organized, where I can spend more time there and bring more players in. But yeah, I mean, right now I just have 4 or 5 players that I'm working with them. With one of them is a WTA player, on the women's tour. She's about 130 in the world right now. She's the number one Mexican, female player. Her name's Renata Sarasua. And, the other 4 players that I work with are all junior players. 2 of them are about to go to college, and 2 of them are just a little bit younger and still competing at a high junior level. So it's fun because I get to do a little bit of everything. I get to go to some big tournaments. I was just in Miami for the Miami Open with Renata. So that was exciting, to be in that atmosphere at the highest level of the game. And then I also get to go to local, 14 and under tennis events. So I love it because I get to see, kind of the whole spectrum from the young junior tennis player all the way to the pro level player. And it's just fun and exciting, and honestly love what I do. I'm so grateful for the game of tennis and what it allows me to do and everything that I've experienced with it. So I'm just really excited to do what I do here in South Florida.
Is there a great way that somebody can get in contact with you if they wanted to kind of reach out to you?
Yeah. you know, I can give out my personal info. I'm like I said, it's one of the reasons why I'm transitioning to a club now, just so I could have a little bit more structure. And then hopefully soon I'll be able to have, you know, a set address and facility that I can promote a little bit better. But right now, if people want to reach out to me through email, my email is my first and last name, HugoArmando27@yahoo.com. Or they can feel free to reach out to my phone number. It's 941-840-4711. I'm always happy to help and advise people and hopefully give them as much information as possible to help them make the most out of their tennis game.
So maybe, Hugo, when we're down in Florida in about a week, I can get a free lesson in, because I thought that I was a pretty good athlete once, and Hunter knows this story, until I went to the Isle of St. Lucia for a destination wedding, and my girlfriend at the time swamped me 6-1, 6-love. I had no idea with the demands. We'll just call it the demands of the game.
That's a good way to put it.
Very, very, very humbling. And this is when I was still in my 20s. I still had it going on.
So that was like what, 5-6 years ago?
just a few. But really appreciate you taking the time to kind of join us to share your insight. You are definitely more of the Mindful Mecca group that we want to surround ourselves with as it relates to high performance, sport performance, life performance.
Yeah. So
I credit you for coaching that, for preaching that. And we really look forward to meeting you in person and seeing what we can get cooking down in Florida with you and your bunch. So thanks so much for joining the Head Game, Hugo Armando.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I'm looking forward to learning more from you guys and talking to you when you come down here. And again, it was a pleasure. It was awesome. And thank you for doing what you do. I mean, this is something that needs to definitely get out there more. So very appreciative of the opportunity to be on here with you guys and for everything that you guys do.
All right. We'll see you soon. Take care.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.